Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 5th of April, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today, we have Ben Rubin and Debbie Evans. Now, we're going to get started with Ofcom, who have published their plan of work for 2024 and 2025. And it's really exciting. It's so exciting. It's impossible to know how they're going to actually get through it all. So let's have a look at a couple of the items that they're talking about here. First of all, they are going to work this year to develop a media that we can trust and value. Audiences can watch and listen to public service content, which is broadcast across the UK and reflects its diversity. A plurality of choice of a wide range of providers and producers competing fairly for audiences. And of course, what they don't say is that as a result of the online safety bill, there will be a plurality of choice with regard to whether it's BBC or ITV or Channel 4 or GB News that you watch. But the content will be the same on all of those platforms. More or less. But don't worry, audiences are going to be protected from harmful content, while freedom of expression is safeguarded, but only certain types of expression. They then talk about living a safer life online. So services have appropriate governance and accountability arrangements in place to assess risk to users, especially children. So they keep banging on the child drum here. Users are aware of what they can do to be safer online, including controlling the content that they see. And part of this is all about making sure people are literate with respect to the internet and so on. And the final item here, as I'm sure Ben will have something to say about, is trust. Ofcom is established as a credible and trusted online safety regulator. With whom? Maybe with other online safety regulators around the world, not with the general public. But if you put that back on screen, again, there's a third one here, which is enabling wireless services to the wider economy. And they're saying that spectrum is available to enable the communications industry to meet anticipated growth and innovation in consumer mobile and wireless services. And this is, they're talking about here, millimeter wave technology, which still hasn't been rolled out in the UK yet, but they want to roll out very, very quickly. And as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, they will be running an auction in order to auction off the spectrum to the various companies that are involved in providing mobile services in the UK. So that is really what they're talking about with respect to their business plan. I went to look at how many jobs they have advertised at the moment, because they don't have the staff to actually pull this gag off at this stage. And they have 8 roles available at the moment, none of which are with respect to online safety or the media at all. So it's not clear how they're going to manage to succeed here. But don't worry, it doesn't end with these types of issues, because they also talk about AI. They have also published their strategic approach to AI for 2024 and 2025, because Ofcom will also be the regulator for AI in the UK. No one knows quite how, but that's what they're going to be. And this is basically what they're saying. They're saying whatever the government says. So that they're quite happy with the government's approach to AI regulation. Now, of course, while all this is going on, they continue to have their call for evidence on online safety regulation. We talked about this a week or two ago as well. And they're looking for evidence mainly from the platforms on how they're going to meet the obligations under the new Online Safety Act. Reddit has now, or in the last week or so, decided to wade into the debate here by saying, well, basically, we are going to quit the UK, or, well, maybe not, actually, because they aren't really in a position to quit. They're just about to IPO, so they're about to launch on the stock market. And they are particularly concerned that the online safety regime, they're not so much concerned about it as it stands, but they're concerned that the way that the online safety regime might be implemented means that they, as a smaller organization, by comparison to Meta or to Twitter, would be unfairly discriminated against, because the regulatory burden on them would be higher as a smaller business. So really, this is just them giving their feedback on how they see the situation going. But Ben, trust is absolutely at the heart of this. Media literacy is at the heart of what Ofcom wants to do over the next 12 to 18 months. But, you know, frankly, they don't have the budget to pull all this off. So I'm not really clear how they're going to achieve it. But I just thought you might like to comment on the trust issue in particular.
Trust as it relates to Ofcom, I think they've got an uphill struggle. Let's just put it like that. And they're going to be trying to enforce trust, ram it down our throats using algorithms, using this technology. But I think that the harder that they try, the less we're going to trust them ultimately.
Yes, indeed. Let's come to you now, Ben. And of course, in the meantime, we've got other policy agendas working hard in the background. B Corps, because net zero is on its way.
Absolutely. Yes, there are many agendas afloat in society at the moment. And in March, we saw a big noise about B Corp, the industry body, focused on the certification of small businesses to show that they adhere to a very specific set of operational and ideological principles. There was a big noise about it, and we've got a short film here to introduce the section.
Was that a common purpose they want to see fueled, Ben?
I think it might be. Yeah, absolutely. How funky, how cool, how exciting. Like, everyone can get on board with it. No more business as usual. Companies are for the people and the planet, not just for profit. Brighter, bolder, better. It's a bit like Build Back Better, isn't it? And actually, this stuff comes from the same place. It's basically a way of disseminating ESG, SDG, all that kind of stuff out into the economic system. They're pretty well established now. It's been going for around 15 years, and they are well established in the UK. It's one of the most developed markets for them, actually. They've got this handy little map that they put together, which lists 1,865 companies all around the country, yeah, full national spread, and they're aggressively expanding their memberships, what B Corp Month is all about this March. So they've been up in Manchester. They created a mural with the names of lots of different B Corps. People very excited about that. They've also been in Liverpool and also all across the north of England, actually. Big focus on the north this year for B Corp Month. So you can see this outdoor ad on the side of an HSBC in Liverpool. It's all about forward, it's progress, right? This is the progressive mantra. We've got to move forward. We've got to get away from what we've had before. That's all terrible. We've got to go to this brave new world that we're going to create. They've got glowing coverage all over the progressive press, as you can imagine. The Guardian have been talking about it. Also, the big issue here gave them a really good write-up, unsurprisingly, given that this was actually written by the guy that runs B Corp in the UK. It's what they call native advertising, by the way, and that was paid for by GIFGAF, who is a B Corp. GIFGAF, the mobile phone network operator. They produced this funky little B to Z of B Corps. You get it? Quite cool. Yeah, a little creative idea there. Build the story. Waitrose got in on the act, right? I mean, this is absolutely everywhere. It's inescapable. Yeah, outdoor, in the press, in stores. So Waitrose have put over prime promotional space to push B Corps, yeah, in their stores, really ramming the message home for Middle England. They also did this big national survey to explore awareness of B Corp certification across the country. Apparently, it's all great news because 58% of people said that business certification helps them make decisions about where to spend their money. So that's a good statistic. Or B Corp, people value this kind of thing. But there's still some work to do. Only 38% of UK consumers know what an actual B Corp is, as opposed to just more broadly understanding business certification. So it's not quite a household name yet, but they're getting pretty close, to be honest with you. There's a lot of energy going into this. And there's a lot of companies out there who are very, very proud to stand up and talk about being part of the movement, right? It's a real badge of honour for the people that are involved in it. So they put it all over their brand, all over their product, all over their websites. And that's actually a lot of how the route to finding out about this stuff for people. People are genuinely view them quite favorably. So over the last 6 months, 71 respondents agreed that the B Corp certification is having a positive impact.
Sorry, Ben, to interrupt. Just to say that's 71% of respondents.
Yes, so 71% of the people involved in the survey said that they thought the B Corp, that knew about what B Corp was, said that they thought B Corp was having a positive impact. So broadly speaking, people think that it's a positive thing. Like, they've done a very good job of PRing themselves and building awareness and consensus around this. And actually, it goes beyond just this as being a kind of social movement, which is how it's positioned. And there's actually some quite significant statistics coming out of their survey saying that people would like the government to introduce new measures to encourage all businesses to behave like B Corps. They want to regulate for this. They're actually actively promoting that. So there's this thing called the Better Business Act that they've introduced, and the B Corp is basically standing directly behind. They don't call it B Corp, but they're actively involved in this. They want to change UK legislation to ensure every company in the UK aligns the interests of shareholders with those of wider society and the environment. But Debbie, you'll recognise a lot of this language. It's all very much linked into what's happening with Terra Carta and that whole agenda. They've actually been updating, been really busy, right? Like, all this promotional stuff. They've also been looking at their core certification as well, which they've updated over the past 18 months. They've introduced a whole bunch of additional requirements. They've made it even more rigorous and even more difficult to achieve certification. I actually sat on a call about 10 days ago now with between B Corp and an organization called Futurist. And what they've been doing, as well as adapting and extending the certification, they've been building a digital platform that will contain this. And they've taken the 600 pages of documentation, right? It's a 600-page application that you have to go through. So there's a really serious amount of work and a serious number of things that have to be complied with in order to become a B Corp. And they've turned this into a digital platform, and they're using artificial intelligence to translate it into all of the different languages that would be required to disseminate this stuff globally. There's a really interesting use case, an example of AI being used to disseminate and coordinate global policy from Western nations. B Corp started in the US, it's heavily present in the UK, out to an international audience in all those different countries and markets around the world, right? This is a really significant thing. They've also updated, again, as I said, really busy, updated their global leadership team. They've introduced new board roles for a gentleman called Andrew Cassoy, a lady called Katie Hill, another lady called Janine Rio. I'm going to focus just on Andrew Cassoy, actually. He's a really interesting fella. He was one of the original founders of the B Corp movement. He was also very excited to be invited to become a participant in a Rockefeller Foundation Bellagio Center of Residence that he is going to be participating in this year. So this is obviously all linked into Rockefeller. And we can get a bit more insight into Mr. Cassoy's views on things from this short clip from a recent event that he spoke at in Paris.
The objective was never to build an empire of certified B corporations. The objective was to build a community of leaders. And in building a community of leaders, that they could work together collectively as part of a larger stakeholder capitalism movement to change the narrative about the purpose of business, and then to exercise their collective power. And I know in our community, sometimes the word power is kind of a bad word, but I think it's critical that these businesses come together to exercise their collective power to demand change to the rules of the game, to demand that someday all businesses behave like B Corps.
That's quite a profound set of things that he said there, right? This is the guy that helped to found the movement. It's just been put into a global position on the global board. He used the phrase stakeholder capitalism straight out of the Klaus Schwab playbook. He talked about power, K collective power, organizing in order to transform the system, to make it more amenable to their agenda, and pushing towards a day where all businesses behave like B Corps, yeah? And the platforms they're building, the technology they're building would help facilitate this. Just to land on one specific example, I think it's a nice way to tie it up at the end here. Let's have a little look at Arlo Brady, who is the chief executive of Freud Communications, talking about his thoughts on the B Corp movement as a B Corp certified organization.
Hi, my name's Arlo Brady and I'm the CEO of Freud Communications. Becoming a B Corp was a really easy decision for us to make as a company. At Freud's, we put purpose and impact at the heart of all of our work. And in 2023 alone, we donated more than £2 million worth of pro bono support to causes globally that are aligned with the global goals. We were one of the first at-scale PR agencies to achieve this accolade, and I'm immensely proud of our achievement and the continuing improvement that we're demonstrating as we recertify with an improved score of 90.6. Our B Corp report is launching today, and hopefully this will give you an insight into what life at Freud's as a proud B Corp is all about. For us at Freud's, it's about love and work, and if you like what you read, please do come and join us.
So Freud's part of the movement, very excited about it. Did you notice? Regular viewers will remember the tapestry from Gold's house in Davos. That sits on the walls of the Freud's office in London, apparently, according to that video. Isn't that interesting? They seem to be right at the heart of a whole lot of different stuff, Freud's communications. And actually, if we couldn't make it any more clear where this B Corp movement is coming from and what it's directed towards, Gold's house have actually done it for us. They say here in this post from just a couple of days ago that B Corp standards and the global goals are intertwined and orientated towards the same vision. They are effectively doing the same thing.
Yes, okay. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about this in extra. I've got quite a few questions that have come out of that report, Ben, so thank you very much for that. Now, let's move on to, well, the question is, Debbie, are we ready for war?
Good afternoon, everyone. Yes, and that is the question. And what brought me to this question, actually, was the NHS board meeting last week. Now, it hasn't been published yet on YouTube, but I'm a bit impatient and I like to look at the board papers. And there were a number of board papers that interested me. But we've all become used, haven't we, to emergency drills. The NHS is completely overwhelmed, as we know, too many patients, not enough beds. Are we ready for war? And earlier on this year, Brian featured this report, UK Parliament Ready for War, with a big question mark. And in the next slide, you'll see that the report was formalised at the House of Commons Defence Committee. It was formalised 2023-2024, just this year. But Sky News have been asking the same question, actually, as I've been asking, which is the UK preparing for war amid threats of conflict? And what did they find out? Now, just remember, this report was only on the 3rd of April, so it's recent. So what did Sky find out? Well, they found out that according to leaked reports, there's going to be an exercise next week, a two-day war game, which is going to take place involving the Ministry of Defence, the Cabinet Office and the Home Office. And if we go on a little bit further into their report, we can see that Keith Deer, who's a former intelligence officer and advisor to Boris Johnson, actually says the problem is there is no plan. So do the NHS have a plan? That's my next question. And the NHS board meeting last week brought up their annual Emergency Preparedness, Resilience and Response Assurance report. So I thought, well, you've got to go and have a look in that. Obviously, it's an annual update, so we're not presumably looking at anything too much in the near future. However, let's just dissect it a little bit. So disruptive threats, they're looking at weather, infectious disease, major transport accidents or a terrorist attack. And what I found a little bit alarming was that they're kind of bragging that 370,000 people will be supported by an integrated primary and community mental health service this year and for next year. And my concern is that actually we shouldn't have that many people that need mental health support. But we've got a new NHS resilience team, and we're going to be reviewing the operations. But operations for what exactly? Well, we seem to be looking at mass casualties, burns annex, pandemic, hazardous materials, managing contaminated individuals who present to healthcare. We'll come on to that in a minute. And other NHS buildings. Now, I'm not quite sure what these other NHS buildings actually are. Perhaps they're the Nightingale hospitals, I'm not sure. But clearly you can see that there's going to be implementation of new standards in relation to ambulance services, chemical, biological, radiological and nuclear support to acute trusts. But the other thing I found in their report was that they were talking about energy disruptions. So they're talking about energy supply chain disruptions. But I've just highlighted it there in red because it's slightly different from other reports they've brought out, which is indicating that we may be looking at long duration power outages. Now, I don't know what those long duration power outages exactly are. Perhaps they're going to be extreme weather. Maybe that's what they're going to be focusing on. But what are they basing their modelling on? Why are they doing all of this preparedness now? So here are some of the things that have happened in the last year or so. So they've been looking at the coronation. They said that on May the 23rd, there was a big health input. They needed a lot of coordination. The knife marauder in Nottingham has given them something else to model on in June 23. Then there was a BT technical fault, which meant that people couldn't contact 999. And there were actually 11,500 calls that were impacted before BT could back up the systems. And then if we move on to September 2023, we can see that they're looking at RAC. They're using RAC as a modelling tool. That's the reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete. We've seen that in public buildings and schools and some hospitals. Also, they're looking at the car park fire in Luton. If you remember, we were looking as to whether that might have been caused by an electric vehicles. Also, suspected hijacked aircraft. Nothing actually happened on that incident, but they treated it as a major incident. But then we're looking at November 23, more incidents that they're modelling on. So we've got a water supply interruption. And then, of course, this year, we were looking at that big launch of the measles incident MMR campaign. So they're wanting to uptake on vaccinations, and they consider that a major incident. And then finally, we're looking at 2023 and 2024 carbon monoxide in Lincolnshire poisonings, and even in our very own home county of Devon in Plymouth, they're looking at modelling on the World War II bomb that was recently found in someone's garden. Now, this is all taking place with a tripartite of partners. So we're looking at the NHS, the Department of Health and the UK HSA. And NHS England have now revised this programme, which is going to be implemented in autumn 2024. But who's going to be doing these exercises? The NHS is overwhelmed. We haven't got enough staff. So I found this paper from Cambridge. Can live actor patients in a mass casualty incident exercise benefit as exercise players? And if you look at the discussion there, it says on the next slide, it'll say that it's imperative for staff to know what to do to respond. However, globally, there don't seem to be enough resources. There's not enough staff within the health services to be able to be released to do these exercises. So who does these exercises? Well, look no further than Crisis Cast. And Crisis Cast, they carry out simulations of incidents. So for the UK, the Middle East, and well, actually globally, worldwide, but they're looking at, they work with schools, with local authorities, they work with shopping centres, media, military, criminal justice, government, private security firms, you name it. But who are Crisis Cast? And Crisis Cast actually are the learning and development consultancy, which is another segment all of its own. And also there you can see the National Counter-Terrorism Security Office, Army Be the Best. and Cyber Essentials. Now, Cyber Essentials are a UK certification scheme which shows how an organisation has got protection against any kinds of cyber attack. So the clients, long list of clients here, very interesting clients. You've got the National Counterterrorism Security Office, the Ministry of Defence, G4S, Sussex Partnership NHS. That's interesting because that's where our very own Stephen Lightfoot, who is chairing the MHRA board meetings for so long, he's still chair. Bournemouth Uni, Open University, British Army, and ADS, who kind of a talent spotter in aerospace, defence and security, the UK Parliament and Securitas. And just to finalise this segment and highlight that mass casualties are definitely on the agenda and is asking more questions, I think, than answering. But of course, the WHO have got their finger in the pot too. So if you want to find out more, mass casualty management system document from the World Health Organization.
Okay, thank you for that, Debbie. Okay, if you like what the UK Column does, you'd like to support us, all the information about how you can support us is at support.ukcolumn.org. We do need your support. Well, we'll be talking a little bit more about that in extra in a couple of weeks' time. But please do have a look at that page and help us out if you possibly can. You could pick something up at the UK Column shop. But please do share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. Yesterday, Charles was interviewing Sir Julian Rose. That is up on the UK Column website now. Have a look at that. It's an extremely interesting interview. Have a look at that if you possibly can. It's called The Corruption of the Organic Movement. Another reminder of the interview with Hilary Bartrop, who I'm glad to say is a UK Column member, will be on with us on Extra today to discuss, at least we hope she will, to follow up and to say, well, basically she wants to say thank you to everybody that has offered so much support following that interview. So please join us for that. Also want to remind everybody about the Sounds Beautiful Festival taking place in Dorset and Wimborne on the 27th to the 30th of June. UK Column will be there along with many other people. And Wendy Jane, who's one of the organisers, will be joining us in Extra for that as well. But Debbie, the series of No Smokes Without Fire is doing very well, the series on the Green King, which is, of course, is King Charles. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, yes, I would like to thank everybody. You know, we've had some phenomenal comments and thank you so much and lots of information as well. So the series is growing all the time and getting much more interesting. But I just want to highlight a little bit from next week's No Smoke, which is going to go out, because this is particularly for us here in the UK, but also our friends in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Australia, New Zealand and Canada, particularly pay attention, because we're going to be talking about the Commonwealth and how does it figure in King Charles's plans? Where's the funding streams coming from for King Charles's big sustainable initiatives? And it gets a very interesting story. But I want to introduce you to CANZUC International, and we will be talking about a super Commonwealth, perhaps. And I've got a little bit of video to show you about what is CANZUC and the clues in the initials CANZUK for Canada, New Zealand, Australia, UK. So CANZUC. Let me introduce you to CANZUC International.
By implementing a CANZUC defence agreement, such cooperation would increase significantly, creating a military alliance of like-minded, sovereign nations with a tremendous presence on the international stage. Firstly, the CANZUC countries are geographically positioned to rapidly deploy operations in either the Atlantic or Pacific Oceans, ensuring the safeguard of sea lanes, trading routes, and offshore territories across the world. Given their locations, and by engaging in closer operations, the CANZUC countries would have a formidable presence to ensure international peace and security. And with a combined military budget of over $110 billion, it would be the third largest military power in the world, larger than Russia or any of the EU countries. Secondly, as Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK collaborate together as part of the already existing Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, the implementation of a CANZUC defense agreement would ensure the effective development of signals, military, and human intelligence, advancing public safety and national security across the four countries. Not to mention, with authoritarian governments across the world seeking greater power and influence, a CANZUC defense alliance would provide a united front in deterring hostile military actions, preventing adversarial action via air, land, or sea, and eliminating threats of war, cyber attacks, and terrorism. Finally, with the United Kingdom occupying a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council, a CANZUC military and defense alliance would afford Canada, Australia, and New Zealand representation on this council, providing a stronger, unified voice for these countries and ensuring mutual values of peace and democracy are advocated in all future discussions.
So, there's CANZUC International. I can see probably, Mike, there, you've got a comment.
Well, I was wetting myself all the way through that, I have to say, Debbie. I mean, someday we do need to accidentally leave the microphones on while some of that stuff's playing out so that people can get an impression of what we're saying behind the scenes, because that was just ridiculous. Of course, if the only measure of your defense capability is the size of your defense budget, and of course our defense budget is larger than Russia's, and yet our capability is significantly smaller than Russia's, that the irony in that statement there just had me in stitches. We have to also consider and put that alongside AUKUS, of course, which brings the United States into the picture as well. And we shouldn't forget that. Okay, thank you for that, Debbie. Now, let's move on, Ben. And, are we powering decisions that shape the world?
Someone's powering decisions that shape the world, or they're certainly attempting to, but actually it looks like there's been a bit of backlash, which is what I'm going to talk about. So we're going to dig into the progressive liberal agenda, a big part of which involves putting women, aren't they wonderful, into positions of power and authority all around the system. I'm going to talk about that in the context of some work done by this organisation. It's called Verian. I introduced them back in January. They were formerly called Kantar Public. And they're a big global communications consulting firm formerly owned by WPP, which is the biggest international advertising group. And they were bought from WPP in a private equity deal last year by the old Lehman's brother private equity business. Actually, remember them from the financial crisis. So great bunch of people here. They have a global public policy and communications business. And that, as Mike introduced them, they describe themselves as powering decisions that shape the world. And that includes, using it from their own literature, creative execution of behavioural change campaigns. Yeah, so this is a propaganda outfit, essentially, working with global governance and NGOs. And this female agenda is right at the heart of it. We're going to talk about that in the context of a partnership that they've established with this organization, the Reykjavik Global Forum, whose express purpose is to put what they call trailblazing women leaders and their allies into positions of power to help more women attain and retain power. This word gets used again and again in this ecosystem. That's all they ever talk about, as far as I can tell. So these two organizations have created a joint report. It's called the Reykjavik Index for Leadership. It's about exploring attitudes towards female leaders. It's a big survey that they've run across 13 nations, the G7, the Nordics, Holland. They've had 13,000 respondents. And basically, they asked all of the respondents whether men or women were more suited to leadership roles in a range of different industries and other parts of society. And basically, if you get to 100, then you're perfect and you think everyone should be equal and are equal. And actually, anything less than that is evidence of what they call prejudice. And they're very excited because we're starting to see a downward trend. They've been running this since 2018. The numbers have been going up and have been relatively stable for the past 5 years. But this year, they've gone down. So we're becoming more prejudiced, apparently, according to their survey. And that's being driven, interestingly, by young people in particular. Yeah, so young people are now more prejudiced than their parents. More young people think that men are better suited to positions of leadership than women, right? And apparently, according to the report, that's all to do with disinformation and Andrew Tate and social media. But interestingly, it's actually young women as well as young men who were saying this. Yeah, it's not just a male thing. There is a consensus view forming or a growing perspective that men are actually better suited to positions of leadership than women in almost every area of society. This is obviously extraordinarily bad news for Varian and Reykjavik Global Forum, because as they say in the report, amazing statement for them to make here, our explicit goal is a world in which the Reykjavik Index score of 100 is the norm. And this would be a world where men and women are viewed as equally suitable to lead. Well, nothing to do with whether they are actually equally suitable to lead. It's all to do with whether they are viewed as such and tracked as such in our report. Just think about that. That's a really fascinating statement for them to make. This big multi-billion dollar international corporation funded by private equity money, hyper-focused on delivering this. Now, obviously, the findings have not been particularly positive. If that's their end game, there are four conclusions that they've drawn. The first one, I won't read all of this out. It's probably a little bit difficult to see, but I'll summarize. The first one is the biggest concern is the increase in prejudice that we're seeing in younger people. And their recommendation is that policymakers, business leaders, the media, academic institutions, the whole of society needs to work together to dig into this and to make interventions which can change that, which can make a tangible and sustained impact against reversing that trend. The second point is we got to keep going. And this is the classic double down mentality that you get from the left in particular, right? So they've recognize that their data paints what they call a dismal picture, but there are areas where progress is taking hold, so we've got to stay the course. The third point is we've got to stop thinking that needing to fix women is the answer. Women aren't the problem, according to the report, and we don't need to fix them. The issues are about the way that organizations, companies, and societies work. So we have to re-engineer societies, companies, and organizations in order to meet the stated aims of this group. Fascinating. And then the final point is we need to take a much stronger view about the actions, behaviors, and microaggressions that women and other groups experience every day in the workplace. So those nasty men have got to be put in their place, basically. And we need retraining in order to adjust our behavior, right? And that all feels a little bit, to me, like this, doesn't it? The famous Clockwork Orange re-education scene, right? The beatings will continue until morale improves. I'm not sure that doubling down and insisting on this being rammed down people's throats ever more comprehensively is going to work, ladies, unfortunately. And actually realizing that would be what a leader would do. Anyway, where's this coming from? Three characters I'm going to chuck in the mix that have just popped up to me from this organization I think are really important to look at. First one is the UK CEO, this fella here, Craig Watkins. Now, he's been there for a couple of years now. He joined when it was still Kantar Public, just before the pandemic, actually, in 2019. So he was there through that entire period of behavioral modification that happened. And I'm sure that they were very heavily involved in that, like all of the communications networks. But before that, he was at EY, formerly Ernst & Young, the big consulting firm where I spent a couple of years of my career. And he actually ran business development for the government sector, sitting on top of £165 million in revenue a year, right? So there's a lot of money floating around in this public-private marketplace. And before that, he was a civil servant. He was at the Ministry of Justice, the Home Office, and the Metropolitan Police. So from a very long career in the civil service, he's gone straight to EY, helped them earn a load more money in their government business. And now he's gone into this organization, Varian, and is no doubt using his black book to open up very lucrative deals for Varian inside UK government and elsewhere. Really mucky, this stuff. Two non-execs have just been appointed. Two very interesting non-executive directors. The first one, this fella, Matthew Postgate. He was, up until fairly recently, the chief technology and product officer at the BBC. He also helped launch the iPlayer, was responsible for the migration to mobile, big player in the media world. And whilst he's on the board of Varian, he is also on the board of UK Strategic Command within the Ministry of Defence. right? So the Ministry of Defence is sat right next to this organisation promoting this agenda and focused on behavioural change. Fascinating. Another big hitter this time, David Miliband, the lesser-spotted Miliband, spending a lot of his time these days as the chief executive of International Rescue out of New York, but also bringing his network and expertise to bear as a non-executive on the board of Varian. And what else has he been doing with his time? Well, he's been hanging around with some ladies at Davos House, where Arlo Brady and the Satanic Tapestry go every January to coordinate their plans for global governance. And all of this stuff is linked back to the same tiny little group of people.
Debbie, I'm going to have to ask you what your thoughts are on what Ben's just reported.
Do you know what? I knew you were going to say that, and I'm trying to process this because I'm like, I haven't got any words for a minute. Can I come back to you on extra
yeah,
on that?
Let's do that. Yes, I'm very, very keen to hear your view on this. Okay, well, sticking with gender issues of a type, I want to bring this report on screen. This is a scientific paper called Development of Gender Non-Contentedness During Adolescence and Early Adulthood. And of course, this is talking about people that are experiencing, or children that are experiencing, gender dysphoria of some kind. I just want to bring one of the graphs on screen here. Because what they're saying in this report is that 78% of children, in this case, from the age of 10 upwards, and in fact, they're into young adulthood as well, 78% of people don't have an issue with gender, with whatever gender they think they are. They do not have any gender non-contentedness, as they talk about it. They talk about 2% of people from the age of 10 upwards who have an increasing gender non-contentedness. So that would be increasing from almost never saying that they wanted to be of the opposite sex to being sometimes saying that they want to be of the opposite sex. And then the remaining 19% of people, as they get older, they basically drop this whole notion of having trouble with the gender that they are. So they're saying that that 19% falls from almost never talking about wishing to be the opposite sex to actually never talking about wishing to be the opposite sex. So let's just look at a couple of the points that they make in their conclusion here. First of all, they say, we find that gender non-contentedness is most common around the age of 11, and that the prevalence decreases with age. And of course, the thing that's of particular concern is how children from the age of 11 in particular are targeted with we can help you if you have these problems. And the problems that they have are effectively encouraged in their schools and other places. So if we put that back on screen again, then I just want to remind everybody of the comments that Bertrand Russell made way back in his book, The Impact of Science in Society. And he was talking about the future scientific dictatorship that we were all going to be living under. And he said, I think the subject which would be most importance politically is mass psychology. Its importance has been enormously increased by the growth of modern methods of propaganda. And he said, it may be hoped that in time anybody will be able to be persuaded of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment. Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about who's being provided by the state with money and equipment in a minute. But I just wanted to make the point that catching people young and sort of encouraging these thoughts is something that we've witnessed over the last number of years. Just make the point that this is something that the establishment has understood for quite a long time. Now, coming back to the report then, they said that the results of the current study might help adolescents to realize that it is normal to have some doubts about one's identity and one's gender identity during this age period. That's from the age of 10 upwards. And that this is also relatively common. And they say that our data indicate associations between experiencing gender non-contentedness and a poorer self-concept and mental health throughout adolescence. And the thing that I think we have seen is how that idea of having a poor self-concept and having poor mental health is something which we've seen encouraged in people. And this is, I think, of concern. So now, of course, as a result of this encouragement and the physical harm that's been done to people as a result, the Gender Identity Development Service was closed recently. We reported this at the time. This, of course, is Tavistock and Portman Foundation, NHS Foundation Trusts. But as Debbie pointed out to me earlier, it does say here very clearly that new services for children and young people with gender incongruence are being established with the creation of a northern hub and a southern hub. Now, there's a lot of talk in the media over the last couple of days about the chaotic nature of the creation of these two new hubs. But Debbie, this just looks to me like, just as with other pretty unpleasant NHS strategies like Liverpool Care Pathway, for example, they're just rebranding Tavistock into a new form, and they're just going to carry on regardless.
Yeah, 100%. And I have got something to say about this, because honestly, just a couple of weeks ago in my blog, I was reporting about this new gender service. What they're trying to do is get GPs to sign up to go on a short course, a gender counselling, gender reassignment, gender referral course, so that now there are 5,000 children on the waiting list, and many of them are going to be referred to GPs. And GPs are saying, we don't know anything about gender reassignment, which is why they're being incentivized to sign up, learn, so that now your GP will be your first point of contact.
Yes. Okay. Well, Debbie, while we have you, let's talk about the future of food report from Sainsbury's. I think you mentioned this before, but we got an update.
We have indeed. Sandy and Brian have brought this to our attention before with the 15-minute cities. But my question is, how safe is your salad? Because that's what we're going to be looking at. And of course, in the Sainsbury's future of food report, it goes right up to 2169, which is just insanity. But let's look at 2025. And what they're looking at is food as medicine. And they're saying that people are going to be drawn to food with health benefits, and we should see food as a medicine. And they're even referring to two organizations or two terms there. One's called Shop With Your Doc, and the other's called Fresh Food Pharmacy, with pharmacy being spelt as F-A-R-M-A-C-Y. And the question I think that we all have to ask ourselves is, how far do we actually go? What is the probability or the possibility of medicalizing food like we have medicalized water with fluoride? So I want to take you back to a couple of bits of news that we did a few weeks ago with regards to Tennessee, because there's been an update. So you might remember we featured that Tennessee were considering passing a bill that would prohibit vaccines to be put on food without being labelled. Well, HB 1894 has now added a new definition to the word drug. So HB 1894 states that drugs are also food that contains a vaccine or vaccine material. Now, this bill has passed, and it's now awaiting signature by Senator, I can't remember his name, Bill Lee, I think his name is. It's got to be signed off by Bill Lee. Now, I went to look at what happened in the Senate, and we saw it a few weeks ago. And the first thing I want to just show you is Senator Hensley, who is moving the bill forward. When you listen to him, it's only a very short clip. Just keep an eye on the lady behind him, Senator Heidi Campbell, because she's getting ready to move. So have a listen to the proposal of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 1894 merely would require any food that contains a vaccine or vaccine material would have to be classified as a drug and labeled as such. With that, Mr. Speaker, I renew my motion.
So he's renewed the motion, and now we have Senator Heidi Campbell. She was the lady that was sitting behind. And to be honest with you, you're going to see that these senators are like rabbits in the headlights. listen and see what or hear what Senator Heidi Campbell said.
So while I feel like this legislation is basically anodyne, I mean, I guess it's addressing something that I can't imagine would ever exist, which is the idea that we would somehow be putting vaccines into foods that you would buy in a grocery store. I mean, I can't think of any logical reason why anyone would ever do that. And
so she's completely astounded, but I think we have to look at this bill as the canary in the coal mine. And I want to introduce you now to Senator Frank Nicely, who had plenty to say. Let's listen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Actually, I've been reading about this for a couple of years now, and evidently with this new technology, they can raise this, lettuce is what they're talking about first, they can raise this stuff so cheap. And I've been reading about it, talking about just putting it in lettuce and mass Medicaid everybody like they do with fluoride in the water. I mean, who controls the dose? If you eat a lot of lettuce, you're going to get a lot of mRNA. If you don't eat any, you won't get any. And they're actually talking about other vegetables that they're trying to put this in. And my question is, would this have to be sold in a drugstore? Would you still buy it in a grocery store? Why don't we just outlaw this stuff completely? We don't have any idea what it's going to do to our children, or, I mean, to us, or old people, anything. I mean, this stuff locks out a science fiction movie. I mean, it's ridiculous. It changes your DNA. It's an mRNA changes your DNA. If you have your DNA tested now, and you eat a bunch of this lettuce, take a bunch of these mRNA vaccines, and you go back and get your DNA tested again, it's going to be a little different. It's not going to be the same as it was that you were born with, that you got from your parents. This is dangerous stuff. We need to study it and probably need to outlaw it. I mean, I can't imagine. When I first read about this, I thought, this cannot be true. But you keep reading about it, and it is true. But thank you for bringing this bill, and I just like to outlaw it in the whole state and outlaw whoever's trying to make it. Thank you.
Yes, and I would like to outlaw it as well. And I think I just want to make it completely clear, and this is a message from our very own Cheryl Granger as well, so thank you, Cheryl, in that she wanted me to say that mRNA is not safe in animals or humans, should never have been used, it should be outlawed. And what he was referring to there with regards to DNA was he was referring to DNA contamination. But we'll be talking to Cheryl a little bit more about that another week, I promise.
Yes, and indeed, Debbie, thank you for that. And we're hoping we're going to be hosting a symposium on mRNA in the not-too-distant future and so on. And we should also mention, Debbie, just very briefly, of course, the government is still working towards rolling out folic acid supplementation of flour, white flour for bread and so on, because we've got to medicate the entire population and not just pregnant women. So, you know, have you got any thoughts on that very briefly?
Well, I mean, as you've said, Mike, you know, now we're looking at medicalizing water, we're medicalizing food. If there's one thing in the UK that we're very good at, and it's growing lettuces and tomatoes, so I might suggest that we grow our own. But mRNA is a massive subject. There are hundreds coming down the line. It's not just COVID. It's not just flu. There are many more. But it's going to be something that we're going to be keeping our finger on the pulse and reporting on in the future.
Thanks, Debbie. Now, just want to sort of finish the main segment here on NATO. And obviously, the last 2 days have been a celebration of NATO's 75th anniversary. Some people have been celebrating anyway. One of those people was our illustrious leader. If we can bring him on screen and see what he had to say. In 1949, in the hope of avoiding another devastating war, the UK joined together with a handful of allies to sign the North Atlantic Treaty and pledged that we would also always come to one another's defence. This anniversary is the moment to renew our historic pledge to this alliance and say that no matter who tests us, we will not waver. Now, I think we've touched on the question of whether we are actually in a position to fight any kind of war or not earlier in the programme. The point is that obviously 2 days of foreign minister meetings in Brussels, all about how they would support Ukraine and so on over the last 2 days. And one of the things that they have wanted to do is to move the running of the support for Ukraine into NATO itself. And the United States isn't quite so happy about that. So let's just bring Mr. Blinken on screen as he explains.
Every country represented here at NATO remains rock solid. We will do everything that we can. Allies will do everything that they can to ensure that Ukraine has what it needs to continue to deal with Russia's ongoing aggression. Ukraine will become a member of NATO. Our purpose at the summit is to help build a bridge to that membership.
So he's prepared to go that far and say that Ukraine will become a member of NATO. But Stoltenberg was wanting to go further. He said today allies have agreed to move forward with planning for a greater NATO role in coordinating security assistance and training. And of course, we were talking about this on Wednesday. This takes NATO potentially into direct conflict with Russia. So if we put that back on for a second, then John Kirby had this to say. It's bigger than NATO, this effort to move coordination role into NATO. He said that there are 50 some odd nations around the world, including in the Indo-Pacific, involved in supporting Ukraine. And what brought them together was American leadership. So America not quite ready to cede this power to Brussels just yet. But it was left up to the Hungarian foreign minister to talk a bit of sense here. He said that now proposals will be put forward, which unfortunately carry the threat of NATO crossing red lines, and NATO may be closer to this war than ever before. So some dissent from within Europe, some dissent from the United States, but Stoltenberg and the EU sort of elites very much wanting to see NATO taking a much more hands-on role with the whole Ukraine conflict. As for Russia themselves, this is what the Ministry of Defense was saying. The Kiev regime does nothing without the approval of its Western curators. Now, he was speaking here to the Russian defense minister. They were speaking to the Russian defense minister, and they were really wanting to reinforce the point with respect to the French talking about putting boots on the ground in Ukraine, that they trust that French special services were not involved in any of the recent events around Ukraine, and particularly with respect to the business in the terrorist attack in Moscow. So anyway, the last 2 days in Brussels have been not quite as united as they were hoping for, perhaps, but we've all got to applaud 75 years of NATO, because goodness knows we would be in a much less safe place if it weren't for that organisation. Wouldn't we, Ben? Now, another organisation that makes us extremely safe, of course, is the City of London. So let's just end with this.
To create a more sustainable, diverse and competitive city corporation, we need a plan. And to deliver that plan, we need our people to grow.
And that is why we have our new corporate plan and our first new people strategy, which are intrinsically linked, to guide what we do, how we do it and why we do it, whilst putting our most important asset, you, our people, at the heart of all we do.
Thousands of you have engaged in developing these essential pieces of work by which the City Corporation will live and breathe. And because of this, we now have the strongest possible foundations on which to build our future success and support our staff to unleash their potential.
Changing the City Corporation starts with changing our culture. And through these initiatives, the Corporation will become a place where all have the confidence to try new things, voice new ideas, and embrace new goals.
And where we empower each other to be our brilliant best, to be a world-class organisation where better never stops.
where we can disagree agreeably and be committed to positive challenge, learning all the way.
Through collaboration, through culture, through creativity, through our five-year corporate plan and the new people strategy that you have helped shape, our path for good will be unstoppable in the city, London, the UK and beyond.
So thanks to all of you, each and every one of you, and here's to our fantastic 5 years ahead and beyond.
So Ben, tell us about this five-year corporate plan, because the music was rising.
Right, yeah. City of London, the movie. The five-year plan, I mean, the main thing that jumped out at me about this is like this is the end point of DEI, right? So diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, they use all the buzzwords in there. But you see this a lot at the moment. It's been going on for a few years, but I thought this was like the absolute zenith of this whole thing, right? Because you've got the City of London. It's the belly of the beast. It's the center of a global network of corruption that's existed for centuries. And what are they doing? They're coming out with a propaganda film with, let's be honest, some ethnically diverse people and some women. They saved all the white men to the end. They got a new chief executive who is who would probably describe himself as a black man. I don't like using this terminology, right? But unfortunately, we've ventured into this territory, so we're going to have to talk about it a little bit. And this is now being used as a way of burnishing the reputation of this institution. It shouldn't exist, right? But it's issuing a five-year plan, talking about a sustainable future, and I just think it's an incredibly cynical piece of communication from them, given what we know they're up to.
Well, indeed. Maybe we'll have a little bit more about that next week, but Stalin would be proud. Anyway, we should leave it there for today. I'm going to say thank you very much to Ben and Debbie for joining me, and thank you all for watching. We will be back in a few minutes for some extra with, as I say, a couple of special guests. We'll see you there. But if you're not a UK Column member and you can't join us for that, have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday at 1 p.m. as usual. Bye-bye.